The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 21st of October 2020 on Monocle 24. The Briefing, in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up, the US media goes on the offensive over Donald Trump's business dealings in China. What impact will it have on next month's election? Also ahead,
we tried to get an approach with local leaders in Greater Manchester, a joint approach. Unfortunately, agreement wasn't reached, and I do regret this.
The UK government forces Manchester into a local lockdown. We'll ask whether it could fuel calls for greater devolution in the English regions. Plus, we'll have the very latest on the vast political demonstrations in Chile. And a bit later in the programme...
I'm Chiara Remella, Monocle's culture editor, and today I'll be talking about surprising news coming from Netflix and why regional news matters when it comes to election day.
All that right here on The Briefing with me, Andrew Tuck. Donald Trump's relentless pursuit of the media has been one of the hallmarks of his presidency. He's called respected organisations fake news and even barred high-profile political journalists from press briefings. It's not surprising that the profession is fighting back. Today, the New York Times reports that Trump has a Chinese bank account, despite his insistence that American firms shouldn't do business in the country. It follows damaging claims in the same newspaper about the paltry amount of tax that the US president has paid to the Internal Revenue Services. Well, let's get more on this now with the former US diplomat Louis Lukens. Lou now works for the political consultancy Signum Global Advisors. And thank you for joining us. Perhaps, Lou, first of all, you could just explain to us what this story is. What's he accused of here?
Well, the story is that the Trump Organization maintained a bank account in China for a number of years. And, I mean, the details are still a bit murky, but apparently the Trump Organization and President Trump paid $188,000 in taxes to China during a two-year period between 2013 and 2015. This is very damaging, I think, to him. I'm not sure it'll make much difference in the election, but sort of juxtaposed with the story of him paying very little to no taxes in the United States at the same time that he and his company were paying almost $200,000 in taxes to the Chinese government, there's no way that he can spin that in a positive manner.
And tell me, you say that, I think you're correct, that it's a slightly complicated issue for anybody to get their heads around people's tax records, and that the actual tax issue doesn't seem likely to kind of hurt him with his constituents, many of whom I think probably feel that, you know, they don't like seeing the state being nosy about people's earnings anyway. But do you think this charge of hypocrisy could play out in a bigger way, and the sense that, you know, he's telling people to do one thing where in the background he's still trading in China?
Well, there's certainly the hypocrisy issue, but there's also the fact that he and his campaign are trying to go after Joe Biden and his son Hunter Biden with claims that they have been up to sort of unethical dealings in China. So it's a little hard to make that accusation on your opponent when you're on the front page of the newspapers having done sort of similar things to what you're accusing your opponent of. I don't think it'll make much difference in the election, because really, at this point, there are very, very few undecided voters in America. In fact, almost 40 million Americans have already voted. So, you know, there may be a few people that feel who are undecided, who feel this is the final straw and they won't vote for Donald Trump. But it does, you know, it complicates his messaging as he goes into this last 2 week stretch before November 3rd.
And tell me, Lou, we hinted at that, the introduction to this story, that there's a sense that many of the news organizations who've been hammered by Trump, accused of all sorts of fake news accusations in recent months, in recent years, are now beginning to hit hard with some of their investigations. Do you think that this is just coincidence, or do you think that actually in the closing days of this part of his presidency, that they actually are determined to try and overturn his rule and make sure that, you know, Biden gets in?
I don't think so. I think this is a coincidence. Look, the New York Times and other sort of well-established news agencies in America have been investigating Trump and going after him and printing negative stories about him for well over 4 years now. So I think the timing of this is coincidental. I don't think that the New York Times and other organizations are on sort of a witch hunt to try to, you know, wrest power from Donald Trump. I think that's not their role. I don't think they see their role that way. Donald Trump, by the way, has been very good for business for these news agencies. They're all having record revenue and subscriptions. So, you know, it's a bit of a double-edged sword if Donald Trump leaves and we have, quote unquote, boring Joe Biden in office, the news worthiness of the White House may be less than it is now. But anyway, all by way of saying that I don't think this is a hatchet job by the New York Times specifically trying to get Donald Trump out of office. I think the story has come their way, and as they have done for many years now, they publish it.
And for you personally, when you look at the coverage of, say, Donald Trump versus, you know, the accusations against Biden, against his son, you know, this story of the hard drive, images which are certainly circulating in newspaper websites here in the UK of his son, do you think that the papers are playing that equally? Again, you know, I think that many critics wonder whether some of these papers are pulling their punches a little bit on the Biden story because they're concerned that if it gets too much airtime, it could undermine his chances of getting into the White House.
Yeah, I don't know. The issue with that story, of course, is the provenance and where did it come from and how reliable is the information in it? I mean, certainly some of the pictures that are attached, I think, you know, it'd be hard to claim that they're falsified. But I think the news agencies, the respectable ones at least, are asking themselves, what is the real news value of the story and how does it affect Americans' decisions whether to vote for one candidate or the other? And I think some of the more respectable news agencies have made the decision that a candidate's child's addiction issues is not necessarily relevant to the debate of the day.
And just tell me a final question, stepping aside from the news agenda, as you watch in these, you know, final days as we run up to the election, what's your feeling? I'm not sure if you're a betting man at all, but what's your feeling of where we currently lie, what the prognosis is for the outcome?
Well, look, I mean, we've written about this a lot at Signum. I mean, Joe Biden is going to win this election, and we think he's going to win it with a very substantial margin. Donald Trump is in the last 2 weeks of this campaign. It's his opportunity now to make the closing argument to the American people of why they should reelect him for four more years. And his closing argument seems to be attacking Dr. Fauci, who's one of the most respected public officials in America right now, attacking the notion of listening to science when it comes to the coronavirus, and basically in a full attack mode on everybody, which is exciting for his base, and it gets him lots of cheers at his rallies. But it's not a compelling closing argument for swing voters in America who are still undecided and trying to decide which candidate to vote for.
Well, thanks, Lou. That was the former U.S. diplomat, Louis Lukens. Now here's Monocle's Yoline Goffin with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. The French President Emmanuel Macron has urged Russia to boost cooperation in fighting terrorism. It follows the murder of a Parisian teacher called Samuel Paty by a Russian-born man. The European Union says the UK has sovereign choices to make on Brexit, and they will determine its future access to the internal market. The EU says it is up to London to break an impasse in trade negotiations. The Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga says that he opposes any actions that escalate tension in the East and South China Seas. His comments came as he concluded his first overseas trip as Japan's leader. And today's Monocle Minute looks back on the life of the Italian furniture designer Enzo Mari, who died on Monday at the age of 88. You can find out about Mari's extraordinary achievements by heading to monocle.com/minute. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Andrew.
Thanks, Yaline. Well, the UK's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has imposed strict new restrictions on Greater Manchester, despite fierce resistance from the city's mayor, Andy Burnham. The ongoing spat has laid bare the political divide between the north and the south of England, and it's also led to calls for local leaders to be given more political autonomy. Well, let's get more on this now with Lance Price, who served as Director of Communications at No. 10 Downing Street. A very warm welcome back to the show. Lance, is this a real divide between north and south that's going to play out for months, or is it just temporary? Because the feeling is that maybe the restrictions that we're seeing in the north of England are going to have to be imposed in the south in the coming weeks and months. And once the whole country is blanketed in these very strict lockdown measures, would that kind of appease, in a way, northerners who are feeling a little bit kind of picked on at this time?
Yes, I mean, it all depends on how the government decides to tackle the crisis. At the moment, they're determined to do it on a local and regional basis. So if you have high coronavirus figures, you're going to be in stricter lockdowns of one sort or another, stricter controls on the freedom of movement. Now, there are those who say that that is logical, because that's where the problem is, or that's how you deal with it. But there's a very strong feeling in the north of England that it does discriminate against them, and it has exacerbated the sense that there is this north-south divide, where you have northern leaders, whether they're mayors or council leaders, who are very focused on the needs in their individual areas and are able to portray the UK government as being out of touch, southerners who are only interested in keeping the costs down and have no real faith in the UK as a whole tackling this together rather than dividing it.
But I just wonder, you know, it's a place that you know well. You spend lots of time in Yorkshire, but how real is that division? Because it's only a short time since we had a general election which saw numerous voters in these very constituencies voting Tory, many for the very first time, because actually they saw with the Tories a more common cause around Brexit, around a national story. So if they do get on top of COVID, is this really a proper crisis that's going to have long-term impact, or is it just really this moment where the North feels this disparity in treatment?
Now, all of that's true, and it would be ridiculous to suggest that voters in the North of England, I'm speaking to you from Yorkshire, you know, voters, northerners first, and that's all that matters to them. Of course it's not. If that was the case, then you'd have a very different political map than the one we have at the moment, and certainly than the one we had at the 2019 general election, as you rightly describe. But what's happening at the moment through the coronavirus crisis is putting to the test the promises that Boris Johnson made to voters in the north during that general election, when he said that he understood them, that he could represent them better than the Labour Party could, and that he would level up across the nation. That is to say, to ensure that the North got the same benefits, the economic benefits in particular, that the South has had for a very long, long time. And this health crisis that we're going through at the moment is the crucible that is testing those promises. And many leaders, civic leaders, municipal leaders, mayors and so on in the north of England are obviously trying to use that as an opportunity to call the government to account and expose where it thinks that it's letting the people of the north down by not living up to those promises.
Well, of course, we went for a long time without many of these cities even having their own powerful mayors. Now they've got them. some of them would like a little bit more power. Do you think that would work in the environment of the UK? Because, for example, with Andy Burnham, you know, that there is a feeling from the medical professionals that if he was allowed to have had his way and not pushed through, being pushed into these tougher lockdown measures, that he could potentially have overseen a situation where some of the hospitals would have been overwhelmed in coming weeks with the numbers of people admitted to ICU units.
I mean, I think what's going on will put to the test whether or not regionalism and more devolution to the local areas of the United Kingdom can work. It's been a big debate that's raged for a long time, a very long time, in the UK, but it hasn't really been of great interest to a large majority of voters. So the proponents of more devolution to the regions, for example, people who say that Yorkshire should perhaps have a government of its own, a parliament of its own. After all, it has a larger population than Scotland, which does have a government of its own. So why should Yorkshire be different? Those proponents haven't actually managed to get much enthusiasm from the people in the areas where they live. Now, this may be starting to change now that regional mayors have got a much higher profile as a result of what Andy Burnham's been doing in Greater Manchester and some of the other mayors have been doing in Liverpool and Sheffield and elsewhere in the country. There's a lot more interest in the whole idea of devolving power to the regions. And I think it's a ratchet effect. You hand more power to Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland. That happened a long time ago. Increasingly now to city mayors. It's very hard to take that power back again. So the ratchet tends to go always in one direction. And this may be a major boost to those who've always said that it would be better if more power was devolved to regions of the UK, but haven't managed to get the public support for it. Maybe that support will start to grow.
Lance, there's one thing that I was really fascinated about this week and what Andy Burnham has done. So for listeners who are not here in the UK, you know, he fought strong and hard for his city to be given additional funds to help businesses that were being forced into lockdown. In the end, Boris Johnson wouldn't give that to him because, you know, he felt that he'd already given a certain amount of money to other cities such as Liverpool and it would be unfair. So he's now kind of forced him into these measures. Andy Burnham has certainly, you know, done well by the people of Manchester. Many of them seem to have been very kind of buoyed by his attitude. But at the heart of it, he was arguing for something that's quite interesting. He was saying, don't go along with these national measures and these tiers of lockdowns. Let's do our own thing, which is shield the most vulnerable and allow the rest of the city to kind of carry on in a more interesting and economically successful way, which is fine. But that's certainly not what Keir Starmer, the leader of the Labour Party, has been saying in recent weeks and months. And oddly, you know, certainly Keir Starmer wasn't particularly running up to Manchester to kind of, you know, stand on the same soapbox. Do you think that oddly, while Keir Starmer would have been delighted because, you know, there's been this row, it's been interesting, it's pushed Labour to the fore, it does show that there are divisions in the Labour Party as well, the opposition to, you know, what Boris Johnson is doing, which isn't hard to be opposed to it, that even within the Labour Party, there are those who think, actually, these national measures don't work. We don't agree with the tiers. We don't agree with the numbers. And we would like to experiment with some other local opportunities, which again makes you wonder what would happen if he really did have the power.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky for the Labour Party and for Labour politicians. But up until now, they've just about been getting away with proposing two different things, as you suggest, at the same time. And I think where Andy Burnham and Keir Starmer would agree would be to say, look, if we're going to have severe lockdowns, then let's do it across the country so that everyone knows what the rules are and we all do it together and it's fair and no one's picking on the North. If you're not going to do that, if it's going to be done on a regional basis and local leaders are going to be brought into the argument, are going to be given the powers to make their own decisions, then you have to let them make their own decisions. So therefore, devolution and local democracy has to mean something. You can't have all the decisions made in Whitehall by Boris Johnson and by his cabinet and imposed on the regions if at the same time you're trying to pretend that those regions are partners in what's going on. So there are two different arguments. They can just about run in parallel. And at the moment, it seems that that is the Labour strategy. If we're going to have a if we're going to have a strict circuit breaker, then it has to cover the whole country. If we're not, then devolution has to be genuine devolution, and the money has to be there to support people through the difficult sacrifices they're being asked to make, if they're only being made in certain parts of the country and not everywhere.
Well, I think it's a story that's going to run and run. But Lance, thank you very much for joining us. That was the political commentator Lance Price. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. The global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Today, the company is working on breakthrough treatments that push the boundaries of human understanding in biology, data science, and engineering to develop and deliver therapies that help people live longer and healthier lives around the world. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You're back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. I'm Andrew Tuck. We're going to take a closer look now at Chile, which has witnessed political widespread protests in recent days. I'm joined on the line for the very latest by Monocle's Latin America Affairs correspondent, Lucinda Elliott. Lucinda, this all began a year ago. Can you remind listeners what the trigger was for all of this and what's really at the heart of all of these demonstrations which continue to this day?
Yeah, so protests in the thousands went on for about a month during October and November last year, and there was widespread arson, looting, vandalism that caused actually about $4.5 billion worth in damage to public infrastructure. And it was one of the biggest anti-government demonstrations we'd seen in the region for some time, and came as a surprise, partly given that Chile is one of the more politically stable and prosperous countries in South America with relatively low rates of poverty. However, the cost of living has really shot up in recent years. And at the same time, income from benefits such as pensions had fallen. And it really kicked off when the price of a metro ticket was put up by less than 2%. But then it spread to all sorts of other social welfare issues and a call to actually rewrite the constitution.
Now, that rewriting of the constitution, there's a vote on Sunday, which is more about how a kind of change to the constitution would potentially happen. And then next year, there would be a vote on actual changes to the constitution. I'm trying to kind of get my head completely around what people are voting for on Sunday. Can you explain to listeners what the issues are up for on Sunday?
Yeah, so this is a way, I think, almost to sort of quell protesters, because they've been repeatedly demanding, as I described, since the end of last year, that the current constitution in Chile that dates back from 1980 and was drawn up by the military dictatorship of General Pinochet does not protect human rights or social welfare, and that it concentrates power within an elite group, allowing the private sector far too much economic control, and that it also lacks some form of legitimacy because it was forced on the country by the military dictatorship. Obviously, critics now say that this whole call for a new constitution itself that will open up this wider discussion and then be voted on again with new measures next year kind of lacks legitimacy in a way, given that it will have also been forced into being by social unrest, just as the current one was imposed on the country by the Pinochet regime. But yes, looking ahead, President Piñera has basically agreed to hold this referendum that is due to be held on Sunday, and it's very likely that it will be passed, which will open up this idea of rewriting the constitution at a later date.
And obviously, we tend to think of the country as being incredibly wealthy in comparison to other Latin American countries, but there's still a huge amount of poverty there. One of the things they've done to try and alleviate that, it seems to be, is allow people to take some money out of their pension savings so they have access to cash. Is it a feeling this is also really about poverty as well and access to wealth in the country?
Yes, I thought this was a very interesting point because as I said, the demonstrations were also sparked around this contentious issue of the pensions benefits and people not being able to withdraw them. But they approved this law in June, and it was passed by 2/3 of MPs that was created essentially to give quick cash to millions of people in Chile who lost jobs because of the lockdown measures. And so Piñera's government actually had opposed this emergency relief measure. He wasn't too keen on it at all and thought, well, we'll just do it through public spending. But polls show that nearly 9 out of every 10 Chileans actually plan to access their pension funds to pay for basic goods and services and make certain investments. And so it was approved. And I think it's a different way to approach the kind of economic fallout from the pandemic. Economists say that Chile could actually get a short-term boost from this pension scheme idea, the results of which we'll see in coming weeks and months, but then obviously calls into question the profitability of those pension schemes for savers further down the line. But I think it could be something that other nations will look into.
And just finally, I see that the COVID infection rate in Chile, it's actually one of the Latin American countries that's done pretty well at managing the outbreak. On the 20th, they reported 1,100 new cases, but they had like 6,500 cases at the peak, neighbouring Argentina going in the opposite direction, it seems. So is COVID less of a worry now in this debate? Is it more about fundamentals about how the country is run?
Yes, I think certainly. And I think one of the key issues is that actually in Santiago, these lockdown measures weren't nearly as strict as they were in other major Latin American cities. And actually, it was considered sort of voluntary. But these underlying issues have been bubbling over. And the pandemic is just seen as yet another issue, which is obviously creating an awful lot of hardship for millions. And so I don't doubt that these protests, whether they are largely peaceful — it has to be said that most of the protests on Sunday were largely peaceful demonstrations and it was a very strong fringe group that was looting — will be set to continue.
Well, Lucinda, thank you so much. That was Monocle's Latin America Affairs correspondent, Lucinda Elliott. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. And finally, on today's programme, Monocle's culture editor, Chiara Rimella, joins me now for a roundup of the stories that she's been keeping an eye on. Thanks for joining us, Chiara. We're going to begin with Netflix and a hint that perhaps not world domination is the only thing on the cards for them.
Well, yes. I mean, I call it a surprising story because we're just so used to thinking that Netflix is just doing extraordinarily well in the current climate. And naturally it is, when you think about the fact that they do have almost 200 million subscribers overall worldwide. But they've posted their latest numbers, and in this quarter they've added 2.2 million subscribers, which seems like a lot, but it's still under their forecast and under the same results in the same quarter last year. What happened was that they obviously had a huge spike in new memberships in the earlier part of this year. And now the slowdown is happening. People are wondering why this is happening. Is it because they just had so many new kind of subscriptions in the earlier part of the year? Is it also because people are getting more used to living with the pandemic in certain regions and therefore people are returning to the cinema? I've been to the cinema recently. I can say it's not quite chock-a-block yet. I think a lot of people are still watching Netflix at home. But it's interesting to see how the narrative can also be more subtle. Clearly, Netflix is the leading player in this field. As I said, they almost have 200 million subscribers. Disney Plus is, I guess, their contender, and they're at 60 million. So we're talking a big difference here. But I think it's interesting to see how the streaming players will also have to keep their guard up moving forward. The main driver to new subscriptions to Netflix is always new content, new original series, which obviously they've also had to halt. So they're now looking at, releasing a lot of this new series into the second half of 2021. There will need to be a bit of a plan for the interim period because they have resumed shooting on a lot of series. They said they've done 50 since kind of the lockdown began, and then they've got 150, I guess, that they aim to complete by the end of the year. But when these will actually come online is a big problem and is a big question moving forward for kind of new subscriptions and growth.
Well, another story which is fascinating, which is about advertisers and the public rediscovering the value of reliable news brands. We like that.
Yes, I think it's good news for us. No, I think it's interesting. This is a story from the Press Gazette, who are basically reporting that advertising are looking increasingly to print and reliable kind of news outlets for their money instead of, I guess, digital outlets, because there's a report that's come out, a survey from Newsworks World, and this is, a survey of people under 36. 77% of those said that they appreciate journalism more since COVID started. 70% of them think that the world would be worse off and democracy would be worse off without journalism. And 63%, I think this is really interesting, say that they feel less anxious when they read a story on a newspaper, on a newspaper page, rather than when they read it on social media. So that says a lot about the way that, I guess, consuming news is also very much an emotional matter and not just an issue of, I guess, the medium through which you get it, but also how it makes you feel. And I think that also, interestingly, there's been a 9% increase in trust in national news brands. This is for the UK, since lockdown, in a general atmosphere that sees trust in news brands in general over the last few years kind of declining. This is good news in terms of where people are rediscovering their trust lies this year, and whether this growth will be sustained moving forward past the kind of peak of the pandemic. Also in terms of trust and transparency, we'll have to see. But also, on the flip side, there's another report come out that links directly local news provision to voter turnout. So for every 1% increase in distribution in local newspapers, there's an equivalent 0.36% growth in voter turnout. So a direct correlation between democracy and news provision. And also, the same report says that local newspapers in print have a bigger penetration than digital news in local communities. I encourage our listeners to look out for our forthcoming issue, because we do kind of go on at length about this point, how regional news really is the backbone of information in local communities, but also in come election day, it does become very, very important.
Yeah, you've done a great story about in the US, about the news organizations in swing states and those catering to clear demographics, whether that's black voters, and their role. And we've also done this thing about Outpost News, a great expo about small newspapers who are delivering great news, often against the odds. And finally, just very quickly, a tribute to Leah Virginet, who died the day after her husband, Enzo Mari, who we've just run an obit for in the Monocle Minute.
Yes, indeed. It's very sad news, and I think she deserves a tribute, of course, on this programme as well. She may not have been as well known internationally as her late husband, but she was an art historian, a curator, and very instrumental in the Italian kind of art world. She wrote lots about body art, and she particularly focused on bringing to the fore female artists through history. So she wrote a book about female artists in the avant-garde, and she died the day after her husband, also for complications due to COVID, but we celebrate her life right now.
Always tragic when partners pass away just within days of each other. But Chiara, thank you very much. Most of it was pretty uplifting, so thank you, Chiara. Our culture editor, Chiara Ramella. And that's all we have for the briefing today. It was produced by Rhys James and also by Yaline Goffin. And our studio manager was David Stevens. The briefing will be back tomorrow at the very same time. But for now, I'm Andrew Tuck. Goodbye, and thank you very much for listening.